The Means of Reproduction, a recorded reminiscence by Conrad Taylor, November 2012. Conrad here with the microphone again, and in this autobiographical episode, I'm going to talk about my early experiences with reproduction. And no, I don't mean sex. I mean printing and copying, making multiple distributable copies of text and images, literature and opinion. That's been a big part of my life, but it's quite frankly a struggle to recall what my earliest such experiences were. I think one thing that helped me to get started is that I've drawn pictures for as long as I can remember. It was a great encouragement that my mum, Connie Taylor, also drew and painted, and sometimes offered technical criticism of my drawing. So artistic expression has always seemed to me like a legitimate, normal kind of human activity. Money wasn't all that plentiful back then, which cut me off from ready access to paint and coloured pens. So most of my drawings were line work in pencil or in ballpoint pen. But I quite strongly believe that working with limited means of graphic expression can be a good thing if it inspires ingenuity and discipline. It's better to be a master of limited means. With pencil drawing, it's easy to reproduce many shades of grey, more than 50 shades of grey to be sure. But to do the same with a biro, or better still, a fibre-tipped pen, you have to learn various tricks of stippling and cross-hatching. If you're good at that visual vocabulary, and you have a pen which can lay down sharp, dense black lines and dots in high contrast, then you've got a way of producing images that are very easy to photocopy or to use for print artwork. I pretty much taught myself how to draw. Some of that was done by copying illustrations from books, for example, Pauline Baynes's black and white illustrations for C.S. Lewis's Narnia books, or Tove Jansson's own pictures in her Moomin books, or the colourful but still keyline-dominated illustrations in the various letterpress-printed children's story compendia that my mum kept from when she was growing up, with illustrations by such artists as Arthur Rackham or Jesse M. King. Often these days, in a mistaken cult of originality, there's a stupid prejudice against copying pictures. But as far as I'm concerned, copying, if you do it mindfully, is good for your observation skills, and it develops confidence in the use of your tools. As for lettering, well, in the top class at St. Cuthbert's Primary School in Newcastle, Mr. Duffy taught us to do italic handwriting. I don't know how many of us kept it up after, but right up to this day, a modified italic script is the basis of my own everyday handwriting. I also experimented with other lettering styles. But what about my passion for the multiplied, the reproduced image? I guess my first experiences of that would have been various kinds of relief printing, where you've got a block of something with a flat surface to take ink or paint, but parts have been lowered, cut away, so they neither get inked nor touch the paper surface. Methods such as woodblock, lino cut, and indeed, if I may lower the tone, potato printing. And of course, rubber stamps. My grandfather, Sammy, my mum's father, had run a small grocery shop, and he handed on to us boys a big box of the letter and number stamps that he'd used for printing price tickets. We also played with a John Bull rubber stamp printing outfit, and I carved a slab of oven-cured modelling plastic into a book plate stamp bearing a griffin rampant. But it was at St. Cuthbert's School that I also had my first exposure to mechanised reprographics, simple mass printing using duplicating machines. Now, people younger than I am probably take the photocopier so much for granted that they're now wondering, didn't we have photocopiers back in the 1960s? Well, the answer is, back then, yes. Chester Carlson had already commercialised the dry toner electrostatic copying process, which he called xerography, from the Greek words for dry and writing. He made a successful little business called Xerox out of that heavily patented technique. In the 60s, Xerox offered machines such as their 813 and 914 copiers. But a Xerox machine back then was way too expensive for a small business, a church, or a school to own. There was an alternative and cheaper kind of photocopy machine that a number of Japanese companies such as Ricoh offered, getting around the Xerox dry process patents. But it was slow and stinky, and the special paper and liquid toner were expensive. Okay as a copier, but no good as a publishing technology. Instead, There were two kinds of duplicating machine that became the principal tools that were used by churches, schools, small charities, political groups, and so on, to print off maybe 50 or 100 or even more copies. The duplicator was used at school for such things as class notes, test papers, geography and science illustrated handouts, song sheets and printed music, that kind of thing. And what we had at St. Cuthbert's was a Banda machine, a spirit duplicator. My American listeners may know this technology as the Ditto machine. Let's see how well I can explain how it worked. Well, first I'm hoping that you know what carbon copy paper is, or should I say what carbon copy paper was. Imagine yourself back then typing a letter to a business customer, and you want to keep a copy for the files. You'd make a paper sandwich up, thus, as your top sheet, the copy you'd post to your customer, probably a nice sheet of smooth white bond paper, maybe with your company letterhead printed on top. Under that, you'd slip a cheaper kind of paper, thin, typically about 45 grams per square metre, often yellow or pink. We called that bank paper. As the sandwich filling between them, if you like, you popped in a sheet of carbon paper. This was flimsy, a crinkly sheet, with the lower side coated with a marking layer containing carbon powder. You rolled this sandwich in around the platen roller of your typewriter. Then as you typed, the impression levers of your machine first struck through the ink ribbon and made a good impression on the top sheet, but the pressure would also sink further, causing some of the carbon on the carbon paper to transfer as a slightly smudgier image of the same letters onto the carbon copy, or CC for short. These days, of course, by a process of metaphor, the only CC you're likely to see is the copy field in emails. But back to explaining the spirit duplicator. I just described how carbon copies worked because preparing a master sheet for a Banda duplicator was a rather similar process. There were these marking die sheets, a bit like carbon paper, but the waxy surface coating of this material was impregnated with a kind of spirit-soluble dye. Imagine taking a sheet of this material. You lay it on a very smooth table surface. A school table covered with formica would be ideal, and you have the waxy dye layer upwards. Now you overlay on top of this a special, strong, smooth-milled and coated sheet of white paper, and that's going to become our printing master. Take a biro pen, and as you write or draw on the top of the white master sheet, the pressure will cause the dye from the donor sheet below to transfer to the reverse of your sheet. So when you flip the white sheet over, you'll see a mirror image of what you've drawn, clearly marked in waxy dye on the back of the sheet. Now you could just as easily roll that two-sheet sandwich into a typewriter and type up your text. It would have the same effect, but you'd have to do that carefully because there was no way to correct any errors. So now we've got our image master sheet. The Banda duplicator machine itself was quite small, about the volume of two or three shoeboxes, I'd say, with trays that folded out on either side, one to feed in the blank paper and the other one to collect the printed sheets. At the heart of the machine was a felt-covered cylinder onto which we clipped the image master, its wrong-reading, die-marked image facing outwards. The inside of the drum was filled with a quantity of a colourless spirit, a 50-50 mix of volatile methanol and isopropanol, which was why it was called spirit duplicating, of course. Now, you start printing on a Banda by cranking the handle. There's no motive force but your arm here, at least on the machines I knew, and the sheets start to march through the machine. A small counterpressure roller just beneath the main drum forces the blank pages into contact with the image master. The spirit, seeping through the felt of the drum and soaking through the image master, carries a bit of the dye onto each sheet to be printed. And that's basically that. If you were at school in those days, you'll doubtless remember the heady fumes that filled the classroom as a freshly printed handout, still reeking of spirit, was being dished out. So that was my first kind of spiritual printing experience. The Banda system had several weaknesses. You could print only onto special paper, and only on one side, and after you'd printed 50 or 60 sheets, there was practically no die left in the image master to print any more. Archival print, it definitely wasn't. The dies were not all that light-fast, and the paper would crumble after several years. But for short-term use, by a classroom-sized user group, it was a beautiful technology. As kids, we got to make several printing masters ourselves, though I can't remember what the project was. And this is where my skills in draftsmanship and handwriting came to the fore. With a fine ballpoint and due care and attention, you could produce some very attractive work. And here was one particularly clever feature. It was easy to do multicoloured printing. You'd probably do the bulk of the design using the dark purple aniline dye colour, which is the darkest option and the most lightfast and the most common. But you could then separate the image master you were working on from that dye transfer sheet and lay it over one for another colour. There was a reddish magenta, for example, and a green. So you would end up with an image master carrying dye markings in several different colours at once, and the Bander machine would print all of them in a single pass, and of course, in perfect register. So that was the printing experience I had at age 10 or 11. We now roll forward about 8 years to my final year at St Mirren's Academy in Paisley in Scotland. And in the course of that, I'd learned how to type. You see, in Scotland we used to have a form of qualification called 6 year studies in English literature, which was examined entirely on the basis of a dissertation which you'd spent a year researching and writing. It's like a sort of baby PhD, I suppose. My dissertation was about the political philosophy expressed in the novels, short stories and essays of Gilbert Keith Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, which has got next to no relevance at all to my story today, but for the detail that I borrowed a typewriter and taught myself to type after a fashion, so that I could prepare my magnum opus with a legible and authoritative appearance. Boys, of course, didn't learn to type in those days. I think the girls at St. Margaret's Convent School across the way did secretarial studies, but men were supposed to dictate. 30 years later, I'm still typing with the same two forefingers. I wonder how many words they've generated between them. At St. Mirren's, I encountered another kind of duplicating, one that paired up very nicely with the ability to type. You could call it cyclostyle, call it mimeograph, or use the trade names Gestetner or Ronio. The generic term for this was stencil duplicating. David Gestetner, a Hungarian engineer who settled in London, invented this technique around the 1900s, and he called it cyclostyle. About the same kind of period, Mr. A.B. Dick in America developed one of Edison's patents into something very similar, which he called the mimeograph. Around 1906, Gestetner set up a factory at Tottenham Hale to make his machines, which is just up the road from where I live now, and his old house in Highbury is a 40-minute walk away from here, with a blue plaque on the wall. By the time I met this technology, Gestetner stencils were made with a cardboard head punched with a pattern to align and clamp them correctly on the drum of the cyclostyle machine. And from this head hung three layered sheets. The stencil itself at the front, a backing sheet at the back, and a carbon paper in between. You'd roll this into the typewriter, stencil side uppermost, and start banging away. The actual stencil layer was, I believe, made of a long-fibred, porous kind of paper, but entirely covered by a waxy, impermeable coating. Each bash from the typewriter would thump into the stencil, a sharply imaged, letter-shaped bruise through which printing ink could be squeezed. Before you started typing up a stencil, you took your typewriter ribbon out of the typewriter first, so that it was the bare type bar heads that smacked straight into the stencil coating for the sharpest possible image. Compared to Bander master preparation, it wasn't that difficult to repair a typing mistake on a Gestetner stencil. There was a shocking pink correction fluid, somewhat like nail varnish but flexible when dry, which you could paint into a mistake to close it up again, and then, after it had dried for a few seconds, you could type over it. A Gestetner, or Ronio, or Rex Rotary, duplicating machine, looked superficially like a scaled-up Bander, but the principle of operation was entirely different. The duplicator ink was an oily black goo, which came in a heavy metal foil tube, like a monstrous toothpaste tube. You would squeeze a liberal quantity of this ink through a filling aperture in the drum, covered with a screw cap. Then there was a certain amount of skill involved in mounting the stencil onto the drum, smoothing it into contact with the ink-sodden, felted drum, and then tearing off the backing sheet that you had used to do the smoothing on with. And then you were really motoring, actually quite literally if you had an electrically driven model which could churn out two or three printed sheets every second. Essentially, the principle was a rotary form of screen printing. The ink for stencil duplicating was quite cheap. The stencils were also pretty cheap. And the paper we used was not extraordinarily special or pricey either. It was easy to get hold of. It wasn't a coated paper, like you needed to feed a bander with, just a bit more bulky, open and absorbent than standard bond paper. About 30-35% more bulky for the same basis weight, I would say. Which meant, as I once had cause to discover, that a ream of duplicator paper made a more comfortable emergency pillow than a ream of office bond. A stencil was generally good for 1,000 or so copies, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 if you were careful. And with care, you could dismount a stencil, remate it with its backing sheet for protection, store it, and then print from it again on another occasion. If you waited a wee bit for the ink to dry, you could easily print on the other side as well. Neither the paper nor the ink were prone to fading or deterioration, and I bet there are thousands of duplicator-printed pamphlets still around after decades of hiding in filing cabinets and boxes in the attic. Now, I've described duplicator stencils as being essentially typed, not drawn. It's true, this system had a good fit with typing, and a less good fit with drawing or handwriting. You could draw, rather crudely, on a Gestetner skin, by placing a cloth-covered, textured metal sheet under the stencil, and inscribing it with a thin metal stylus that was tipped with a tiny ball. The pinch pressure between the textured underplate and the stylus would then generate the kind of bruise that was needed to let the ink through, but you couldn't do the fine handicraft work that the bander system allowed, and there was always the risk in that process of tearing the stencil beyond any hope of repair. Once, and much later, in the jungles of Southeast Asia, I came across a dissident political print shop where an extremely dedicated revolutionary graphic artist had even managed to reproduce photographs with such a duplicator through the pointillistic device of sticking an ordinary pin or sewing needle again and again and again through the duplicator skin, dots closer together to represent the darker shades and further apart to represent the lighter ones, and rows of tiny dots precisely spaced along a line to make finely detailed line work. But that, I'd say, was either revolutionary zeal or madness, and certainly available as a technique only to somebody with quite a lot of time on their hands. For the rest of us, well, until the electrostencil machine came along, about which a brief mention in a minute, we gave up on graphics for the duration, except maybe the patterns you could make with characters on the typewriter, the sort of thing that prefigured the ASCII art phenomenon of the 70s computer age. Well, as I said, I met this technology in my last year at secondary school, and I used it to produce an officially sanctioned school newsletter. The following summer, a bunch of us ran a fundraising campaign in Paisley for Shelter, the campaign for homeless people. I think we had access to a stencil duplicator to produce the flyers and forms that we needed. When I went to the University of Glasgow at the beginning of the 70s, one of the first big purchases I made was an Adler Gabriel semi-portable typewriter, and I was very careful in choosing a machine that would not only give me the kind of typographic look I wanted, but it could also whack out a decent duplicating stencil. Because, you know, one of those little stylish Olivetti ultra-portable typewriters, beloved of the old-time foreign correspondents, it just wouldn't have the leverage, the oomph, for that kind of work. While at and around the university, I made quite a lot of political pamphlets using this technology, and in my capacity as a voluntary helper to the Church of Scotland community worker Stella Ricci, about whom I shall doubtless have more to record on another occasion, I typed up and duplicated shedloads of minutes at committee meetings. Stella had her own little Rex rotary machine in her flat. The student Christian movement had quite a few Ronio duplicators with interchangeable drums for red and green printing, which of course had to be done with a second pass. You could lift the drum out of the Ronio machine and put in a drum loaded with a different colour. I first met those machines at an SCM General Assembly and conference where hundreds of us gathered, conferred, argued, ate and slept in a cold church hall in South Birmingham, and in the evenings, me and a few others produced a daily conference newsletter. I could go on to describe my experience of working with the fancy electrostencil machine that SCM had at its national headquarters and conference centre at Wick Court, That machine could scan a rotating A4-sized artwork image with a sensor photocell linked up to a tiny sparking electrode, and it would burn a carbon stencil with whatever graphics you wanted. But I judge that the topic of how I learned to prepare artwork for the electrostenciler and also for lithographic commercial print would be a fit topic for another one of these audio essays. The continued development of stencil duplicating by the Rizo Kagaku Corporation of Japan into today's line of risograph machines is also not part of my story, but thanks to the internet, you can look up risograph for yourself, see what they're up to. Now, somewhere on the World Wide Web, and I just can't seem to find the reference again, somebody's written that the existence of duplicator technology, and especially the stencil duplicator, was a kind of precursor to blogging and web publishing today. It conferred a freedom of the press, generated by relative ease of use, the relative cheapness of the technology, and independence of commercial interests, which meant that a small club, a political party, or a trades union branch could easily produce their own pamphlets and leaflets cheap enough to distribute at mass meetings or at the factory gate. With a decent typewriter and a duplicating machine, you had ownership of the means of cultural production. It was a staging post for the 1980s innovation of computer-based desktop publishing, which I also met thanks to the Gestetner Company. But that's a story for another day. I hope you've enjoyed this episode.